This, according to the White House, is what's going to be happening in the American economy next week. A healthcare vote, finding a way to fund the government, and, said the president today, tax reform. Still leaves Thursday and Friday, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 21st of April. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. All right, so if next week with Congress back in town is a big get-things-done week for the White House, this week was the do-what-we-can-by-ourselves week. Executive orders have been the order of the day. That and oh so much more in the next 5 minutes of live radio, wrapping up the 5 days gone by. David Gura is here. He's at Bloomberg. Rachel Abrams is at the New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey there.
Rachel, let me start with you. And without getting too much into the prognostication game, can we just look at next week for a minute? It seems ambitious, shall we say.
It does seem ambitious. I think what we're really seeing is that there's so much pressure on the Trump administration to get something done within the first 100 days. We're coming up on that mark. They obviously had a very high profile failure with the healthcare proposal. And so now we're looking at things like tax reform, maybe even a revived healthcare proposal. And there's just a lot of pressure on them to try to push something through by this 100-day deadline. And it's just seeming more and more like that's a bit too ambitious.
David, self-imposed pressure. I mean, the president himself has said, until he said today, that it's really silly and it doesn't matter. The president himself said, we're going to get all this done in the first 100 days. Here's a zillion things
we're
going to get done.
He tweeted that out. He has a very ambitious foreign policy plan, a very ambitious domestic plan as well. He went over and visited the neighbor today. He went over to the Treasury Department and, as you said, signed a few executive actions, including a couple on financial reform and one on taxes. As well, I think he's wrestling with the fact that it is very difficult to work with this Congress. I think a lot of people thought after he was elected, after Republicans were elected to majorities in the House and the Senate, it would be easier. Turns out that's not the case. And so here we have whisperings of maybe some more movement on health care next week. The White House says by Wednesday of next week, we will get the White House plan on tax reform. Finally, we'll get some clarity on what that is. Then you have lawmakers on Capitol Hill who say they've seen nothing from the White House yet, so it seems unlikely that by the end of the week we'll get much more traction on those two issues.
All right, so those executive orders in just a second, but let me just, Rachel, spitball it for me here. Shutdown or no shutdown on Friday when the money runs out?
It doesn't seem to look very good at the moment, but I, you know, I'm crossing my fingers.
David, what do you think? I can't believe they're going to go to the mat and have a shutdown again.
I do not think that there will be a shutdown. I think it'll go to the wire. I think we'll get another one of these short-term spending bills, which will be no victory for either side. But I cannot imagine that Republicans are going to bring that upon themselves.
Yeah. So, Rachel, on these executive orders, there was Buy American, Hire American. There was the change of the procedures for H-1Bs, suspending parts of Dodd-Frank. We've got Adrian Hill coming up with a spot on that in about 2-3 minutes. So much of what the president is doing here, though, isn't actually doing anything. He's ordering reviews and studies of these policies, right?
Right. I mean, the one that I was paying a lot of attention to that I thought was really interesting was basically him instructing Steven Mnuchin to kind of review Dodd-Frank and sort of whether or not Dodd-Frank had sort of gone too far, because obviously this is an administration that's really receptive to business leaders. It's really is receptive to Wall Street, that has been saying for a long time now that Dodd-Frank restricts their ability to lend money, to therefore facilitate the American economy. And so I think Trump is under a lot of pressure to show he's doing something about it, he's thinking about it. But just instructing Steven Mnuchin to review stuff in order to overhaul Dodd-Frank, it would take so much. It takes an act of Congress. It's a baby step, basically.
Yeah. You know what's interesting, though, David, is that Jeb Hensarling, the chairman of the relevant committee in the House, is all hot and bothered to get rid of Dodd-Frank. So there is some synergy there. I just wonder if the House, the White House and Congress can get together.
Yeah, it's another example of these sort of parallel tracks. So he released his version of a bill that would change or repeal Dodd-Frank, something Choice Act. And there you have Congress trying to work to do something separate from the White House. Rachel brings up a very good point, that being that, you know, Steven Mnuchin can review what's going on. He's also the leader of this FSOC, this Financial Stability Oversight Council, that sort of oversees a lot of financial reform issues. And in that capacity, he has some determinism to pick sort of what it does and what might be a systemically important financial institution too big to fail. But like Rachel said, you know, we're retreading a lot of ground here. And what these executive orders do is sort of confirm basically on paper things that the president has said when he was a candidate and during the sort of intervening days, these early days of the administration.
Right.
I agree with her. Not a whole lot happening here thus far.
A lot of that sound and fury thing going on. David Gura is at Bloomberg. Rachel Abrams is at the New York Times. They were both in our studios in New York. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good weekend. Bumpy today on Wall Street. Pretty much a wash by the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so as Rachel and Gura and I were saying, one of those orders that President Trump signed today directed the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, to review some of the tax regulations put in place during the Obama administration, especially those that add, and this is a quote from Mr. Mnuchin, undue financial burdens, unnecessary complexity, and requirements. That, the Trump administration has decided, includes rules meant to stop corporate inversions. Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets us back up to speed.
A corporate inversion, put simply, is when a U.S. company moves its tax address to a foreign country. Brett Wells is a law professor at the University of Houston Law Center.
Foreign-based companies are able to operate in our sandbox in a lower tax way than U.S.-based companies.
Corporate inversions mean companies pay less in U.S. taxes. In 2016, when President Obama announced regulation meant to curb some of those advantages, to limit inversions, and keep more tax revenues here in the U.S., he sounded pretty America firsty.
When companies exploit loopholes like this, it makes it harder to invest in the things that are going to keep America's economy going strong for future generations.
This is one thing that President Obama's Treasury Department has done, that it would be absolutely silly for the Trump administration to reverse.
Samuel Thompson is a professor at Penn State Law. He says it makes sense for any administration to review the regulations put in place by its predecessor. But the Obama administration's move to limit inversions specifically?
I think the Treasury Department is likely or should say, look, this is consistent with what we're trying to do here. That is to put America first.
Eric Toder of the nonprofit Tax Policy Center isn't convinced Mnuchin will come to the same conclusion.
A lot of people in the business community were not happy with that regulation, and I think Republicans generally were not happy with it.
Which means another balancing act for President Trump. How to keep the promises he made to his base and keep on the good side of his party. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
All right, so now this is interesting. The president has changed his tune a bit on NAFTA, or added to his tune, I guess. Not only is Mexico in his trade crosshairs, so too now is Canada. This week, the president went after Canadian dairy rules that he says hurt farmers in big dairy states like Wisconsin and New York. Marketplace's Aaron Trank has more on that.
President Trump was blunt yesterday in attacking what he calls Canada's protectionism.
Canada, what they've done to our dairy farm workers is a disgrace.
The fight is over something called ultra-filtered milk, a highly concentrated substance used to make cheese. Canada created a new classification for this stuff, Class 7, and dropped the price of it, making it cheaper to buy from Canadian farmers. Shauna Morris with the U.S. Dairy Export Council says that hurts American dairy farmers.
Under NAFTA, we have duty-free access for the particular tariff line covered by this product. It is not unreasonable at all for us to expect that we are actually able to sell under that line.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau insists Canada is meeting its obligations under NAFTA and WTO rules, but in an interview with Bloomberg yesterday said,
"Let's not pretend we're in a global free market when it comes to agriculture. Mm. Every country protects, for good reason, its agricultural industries."
He pointed out that the U.S. has a $400 million dairy surplus with Canada. Dairy expert Mark Stevenson at the University of Wisconsin-Madison says this Class 7 milk accounts for less than 1% of U.S. dairy production. The problem right now is overproduction.
If this had happened most any other time, the loss of the particular market that these farms had would have been picked up by some other processing plant.
Maybe here in the U.S. Still, Trump's blaming Canada and promising to press for changes to its dairy system as part of upcoming NAFTA talks. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Authorities in France have promised to increase security on the last day of campaigning before the first round of the presidential election there on Sunday. Last night, that attack on the Champs-Élysées by a suspected Islamist terrorist left one police officer dead, two others and a bystander were wounded. The four main candidates in that race are practically tied in the polls. Speculation is that far-right leader Marine Le Pen might, and I repeat might here, get a bump after last night. Le Pen is promising to revive national self-confidence in France with what she is calling economic patriotism, an end, really, to French globalization. From Paris, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The attack underscored the National Front's basic message. The world is a dangerous place. France must defend itself, and not only against terrorism, but also against the global economic forces that threaten the country. It's a message that has struck a chord with many young French people living outside the big cities. David Berton, a 25-year-old trainee lawyer from southern France.
Le village global, le monde sans frontières.
We reject the global village. We reject this world without borders. We reject the big banks and the power of money that have subjugated France. We, young people, want to stop this. We don't want France to disappear.
More young people support the National Front than any other party. And one of the main reasons, says author Alexandra DeVecchio, is the appeal of the Front's anti-globalization and protectionist policies.
The young people today in France are more protectionist than their parents because they are the main victim of globalization.
In his book, The New Children of the Century, A Fractured Generation, DeVecchio says that youth unemployment of 25% and huge job insecurity have turned many young people here off the whole idea of free trade.
Pour les jeunes, la mondialisation a été synonyme.
For the young, he says, globalization means closing factories, moving them abroad. It's not positive. Many of Marine Le Pen's most ardent supporters come from what is called peripheral France, towns and villages outside the big metropolitan cities, places that feel left behind, flyover states, if you like. And what is Le Pen offering them?
Le protectionnisme intelligent. Je suis pour le patriotisme économique.
Translation: higher taxes on imports and foreign workers, more border controls and preferential treatment for French firms. In other words, an end to globalization in France.
Turn these off because...
That would be a disaster, says young entrepreneur Pierre Gilly, who runs his small electronics startup in a tiny, cramped workshop in the centre of Paris.
This is the place where we assemble our products. This part is an electronics lab, where we develop our own custom electronics for our products.
Pierre's company, Lighted, with six employees, is commercializing a new type of laser with medical and industrial applications. He loves the global village.
80% of our sale will soon be abroad. It's vital for us to be present on the international market.
And he says his business would be badly affected by a protectionist France.
That is a very critical point. I mean, that could really endanger a lot of businesses like mine to be able to develop or even to continue.
Campaigners chant their support for Emmanuel Macron, a centrist, a former investment banker, pro-EU and pro-globalization. He's favourite to win the presidency. So the protectionism of Pierre Gilly's nightmares may well not materialise, but they might. And that's enough to make this one of the most economically critical elections in recent French history. In Paris, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Television, back when I first started, it was a lot easier to make a living.
TV shows don't write themselves, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 30 points on this Friday, about a 10%, 20,547. The NASDAQ down 6 points, about a 10%, 5910. S&P 500 also down 7 points, 0.3%, 23.48. For the 5 days gone by, The Dow up about 0.5%. The NASDAQ up 1.8%. S&P 500 rose just about 0.8%. The world's biggest oil-filled services provider, Schlumberger, said revenue from Russia, China, and the North Sea was lower than expected. That hit its share price, of course, down 0.2%. Oil prices also slid. Benchmark crude declined 2.6% today, ended at $49.40, first time under $50 a barrel in about 2 weeks. United Airlines CEO Oscar Munoz said today he is not going to be the chairman of the company's board in 2018. Follows, of course, that video of the passenger dragging incident. United shares down 0.3% today. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
We host a podcast called Make Me Smart.
And we want to know what you want to know
about business, technology, and culture.
Write to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
And check us out wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. As I mentioned earlier, President Trump said today his tax reform plan is going to be ready on Wednesday. While we're waiting, though, how about getting some idea of exactly where it is all those trillions of tax dollars are going? Anyway, there's a new website. It's called USA Facts, and its stated goal is to help anybody, for the first time, really, get their hands on all of that data, where the money's going. Steve Ballmer, the former CEO of Microsoft, is the man behind it. Steve, thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Why'd you do this? You just looking for something to do in retirement?
Well, I was actually talking to my wife right after I retired about our philanthropic work, and we're focused in on kids who grew up with less shot, let's say, than they deserve at the American dream. And I said, look, it's okay. All we really need to do is to pay our taxes, because the government really serves those communities. And she didn't find that a very good answer, and I found it really important then to go off and really learn the way I like to. I'm a numbers guy, by the numbers. What is government doing with our tax dollars, and how successful are they being?
So how'd you do it? I mean, did you like go talk to a couple of people and said, listen, if I wanted to do this, what would I have to do? Because it's an overwhelming amount of data.
Well, what I really did is I went to my old trusty search engine, in my case, Microsoft Bing.
Oh, cut it out.
Paid promotion. And I started searching around the internet to try to find the kind of data that was useful. Some of the stuff was pretty good, but it didn't have as much detail. It didn't look as much as at outcomes. And I just said, look, I really would like to dive in and understand this more. I went looking for the equivalent of a business 10K.
Yeah.
Certainly somebody must do, government requires companies that are listed to do it, you know, public companies. Why doesn't government do it itself? But such a thing didn't exist, and I made that kind of my retirement project.
So you've got this data now, and it's really well presented. The website is great, and you actually came up with a government 10K, which I spent some time flipping through this morning. And honestly, you could lose yourself in there, because there's all kinds of interesting little tidbits. But what do you want people to do with this? I mean, you're a little bit like Mulholland, the Los Angeles water, right? Here it is. Take it, right?
Yeah. No, I hear you. It's very important to me that we be entirely nonpartisan and we be very complete, because part of what I think happens in the political dialogue is two things. Number one, people will take a number out of context and they'll say it's very large, yeah, when it may not be very large in the context of what's happened historically or other numbers. The second thing is people will use adjectives, and somebody will call something huge and somebody else will call another thing small, and they really are not very far apart. And numbers don't know partisanship. They don't know how to be liberal or conservative. But we don't want to be the people who say this is what the country should do. We want to facilitate, the democratic process and people really sharing this kind of information.
Small d democratic, I get that. And I appreciate the motive. But surely you understand that you are now injecting fact into a post-fact world.
I don't know. I'm enough of an optimist to assume ultimately numbers matter, facts matter. I mean, you could say in the political debate, will these be more front and center or not? But every day jobs will be created or they won't. Every day the government will spend money or receive money from taxpayers or it won't. And ultimately, I think people really do care as budgets get prepared, as people execute their jobs. I think the government and government entities will be every bit as accountable as any business over time.
Do you have a favorite nugget out of all these reams and reams of data you got?
I do have a favorite nugget. Nobody thinks it's as sexy as other favorite nuggets, but I like the fact that I think since 1980, I'll try to remember it precisely, total households are up about 40%, and house fires are down about 50%. Wow. And of all the things that are nonpartisan, fires should be nonpartisan. And of course, that's some combination of the way things get built now versus then, the quality of the fire departments and their ability to do their job. But it is really stunning how much safer we are from fire than we were in 1980.
Steve Ballmer used to run Microsoft. He now does a thing called usafacts.org. Check it out. It's actually a fascinating, fascinating website. Steve, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
There is so much TV out there now, so much content to be watched, no matter the device, that it can be tough to keep up. Great for us, the consumer, not necessarily amazing for the people who write all those shows. They, the Writers Guild to be specific, says their earnings have declined dramatically in the past couple of years, and so Hollywood finds itself once again on the brink of a major work stoppage, as Ben Bergman reports from KPCC.
Burt Royal has been a film and TV writer for two decades, not a household name, but successful enough to have a nice house in L.A.
Television, back when I first started, it was a lot easier to make a living.
Royal points to his most recent show as an example, Recovery Road, an angst-filled teenage drama that aired on Disney's Freeform channel.
You can go to school by day and spend your evenings getting sober.
As is standard in the industry, most writers had to sign exclusive long-term contracts so they couldn't work on other shows.
We wrapped, and then we didn't start airing for another 7 months. And then after we aired the entire season, we're still waiting around to find out if the show's getting picked up for a second season.
They weren't renewed, and Disney had taken so long to decide that writers had already missed out on the chance to sign new deals. What's more, Royal says most of the show's young viewers watch the show on Disney's Freeform app.
We don't make money off of that, so it could get millions and millions and millions of views, and we would never see that.
And even if people had watched on basic cable, that would be far less lucrative to Royal and his staff than if the show had aired on a network like NBC or ABC. Chris Kaiser sits on the negotiating committee for the writers.
The formulas by which we are paid on platforms other than broadcast, that's basic cable or streaming services, are only a fraction of what they were on broadcast.
A central problem for writers is seasons keep getting shorter. More than 20 episodes was once the standard. That's now often cut in half or more. But here's the rub. Writers get paid per episode, and shows today take a lot longer to produce, almost like a movie every week. Think of the production quality of House of Cards or Better Call Saul.
So whereas I, for example, would write 22 episodes and it would take me a year, I have a show on Amazon now, I'm writing 8 episodes. It's going to take me nearly a year, but I'm going to be paid 8 episodic fees for that.
By the Guild's estimate, writer-producer compensation has plummeted nearly 25% in just the last 2 years. So the Guild has a long list of demands for its new contract, loosening of exclusivity rules, better pay for streaming and cable, and help with shoring up their deficit-plagued healthcare plan. If it doesn't get them, a strike could be next. And Kaiser says the union is willing to do this because the companies on the other side of the table, like Disney, are making a lot of money.
There's really no reason why, in an era of expanding company profits, that writers should be suffering.
So what did the studios say? Well, nothing, actually. They didn't respond to our request for comment and have let writers do all the talking. And while writers may win the PR war, it's the studios that have the power and the deep pockets to withstand a long impasse. This could be an unsuccessful strike for the writers, according to entertainment lawyer Jonathan Handel.
The frustrating thing is that what the writers are looking for is about three times what the studios are willing to pay.
The last writer's strike that ended in 2008 took 100 days to resolve. Late-night talk shows went dark, sitcoms and dramas had shorter seasons, there was a lot more reality TV.
So the writers have probably so far never recouped the amount of wages that they lost by going on strike.
And the ripple effects on everyone from caterers to costumers cost the California economy more than $2 billion. The Guild says the strike was important because it allowed them to gain their first toehold into digital rights. The writers and studios have agreed to return to the bargaining table Tuesday, less than a week before their contract expires. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, two of them actually courtesy of Secretary of the Treasury Steven Mnuchin. First of all, Mnuchin has denied ExxonMobil's request for a waiver of American sanctions on Russia. Exxon, as we said the other day, wanted to restart its joint venture with a state-owned oil giant, Rosneft. Also this, just because otherwise it's going to be a long 4 years listening to his boss mispronounce it, this is how the Treasury Secretary told CNBC he pronounces his name.
I'll go with Mnuchin.
Mnuchin. All right, quitting time on a Friday. The Dow off 30 points today, about a 10%. NASDAQ off 6 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 also down 7 points, 0.3%. Sometimes you get hung up, man. Come on. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.